Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's resounding victory in the Nevada caucus and explore his increasingly open path ahead to the Republican nomination with David Lowery, a professor of political science and director of the Center for American Political Responsiveness at Penn State University. He joins us to discuss the options Trump has to win the nomination outright, or if what's left of the Republican establishment is able to stop him, then he could run as an independent. But either way, he's likely to cause down-ticket destruction on the Republicans running in 2016. And while they may hold the House, they will likely lose the Senate and in the states, not to mention the White House. Then we'll speak with Congressman Ted Lieu, who, along with Congresswoman Bonnie Coleman and Brenda Lawrence and Congressman Ruben Gallego, introduced a bill in the House today, the No Money Bail Act of 2016. We'll discuss the outrage that of the 2.3 million Americans in prisons today, there are 450,000 who have not been convicted of a crime, but they are there because they cannot afford bail. And although debtors' prisons are supposed to be a thing of the past, there is a war on the poor underway in America in spite of the principle of innocent until proven guilty and equal justice under the law. Then finally, we'll do an update on Syria as Russia's President Putin engages in a frantic round of diplomacy, calling the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, and Israel today to implement a ceasefire that Washington and Moscow agreed to on Monday. Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and writes the daily blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss how the facts on the ground that the Russians are creating to bolster the Assad regime may lead to a ceasefire, but will not end the war or stop the flow of refugees. And joining us now is David Lowery, who is a professor of political science at Penn State University. Dr. Lowery has published well over 100 papers on the politics of interest representation, bureaucratic politics, urban politics, and public policy. Since 2001, he's been the director of the Center for American Political Responsiveness at Penn State University. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lowery.
Pleased to be here.
And following Donald Trump's blowout victory in the Nevada caucuses, it would seem that I wouldn't say that he's unstoppable, but he's certainly on a roll. And if he doesn't win the Republican nomination outright, he still has the option of running as an independent if the so-called Republican establishment, which I'm not sure what that is anymore, but in any case, if they do try to stop him, as apparently they want to, he could run as an independent. So either way, this is beginning to shape up as a nightmare scenario for the Republicans in 2016.
Yeah, particularly because, you know, he will almost certainly roll into the March 1st and March 15th primaries with a big enough lead to prevent anyone else from winning. You know, so he will walk into the convention, whether he has a majority or plurality, it doesn't matter. You know, with a plurality, he would have sufficient justification to walk and run on his own. So I don't see how, barring, you know, an unexpected event of such magnitude, and it's hard to see one because nothing he's done so far has caused people to leave. But unless that happens, he's really a very strong front runner right now.
And in terms of Super Tuesday and the March 15th elections that follow, it seems that Cruz has got a lead in Texas, but that's not insurmountable, I don't think, for Trump. And for Rubio, he's behind in Florida, from what I understand, behind Trump.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to take these early polls too much right now on Florida. I mean, a lot can happen in a week and so on. But I'd be very concerned if I was Ted Cruz about the Texas situation, because Ted Cruz not only needs to win Texas, he needs to win Texas big, because the way the Texas rules work, if he wins a majority of the seats, of the votes and so on, he will collect all the delegates. But if he's under a majority, he's going to have to share the delegates with Donald Trump. And given Trump's expected lead in the other states, that just won't do it for Ted Cruz. Just winning is enough is not enough for him. He has to win by a lot.
And in Florida, it's a winner-take-all, isn't it?
Yep.
So yep. I guess then you have to figure what's going on with the other two down the field, getting around 4 and 6% at the most. And that's Dr. Ben Carson, who drains votes from Ted Cruz, and John Kasich, who supposedly drains votes from Marco Rubio. I'm hearing that the Rubio people are begging Kasich to drop out. Is that what you hear?
Yeah, they must be. They have to be. And it's hard to see why Kasich is in it at this point. You know, yeah, he's got a shot, certainly at Ohio, and a shot at Michigan and so on. But what does that get him? You know, that gets him only the vice presidency if Marco Rubio is the front runner. But at the same time, it prevents Marco Rubio from being a front runner. So it's kind of a fool's errand at this point.
Well, maybe that's what the backroom conversation is about. I mean, I think you're absolutely on the money that he's only going to win Ohio on the 15th and Michigan, and that would be some bargaining leverage to become a vice president, but it'll prevent Rubio from going out ahead of Cruz in a substantial way. Therefore, he's not likely to get the nod from Rubio. So it's a very interesting situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's you know, the basic problem is that neither Cruz nor Rubio is doing well enough or poorly enough to force the other one out. And, you know, you just can't see a rationale for either dropping, but as long as neither drops, neither can win.
And again, I'm speaking with David Lowery. He's a professor of political science at Penn State University. Dr. Lowery has published well over 100 papers on the politics of interest representation, bureaucratic politics, urban politics, and public policy. And since 2011, he's been the director of the Center for American Political Responsiveness at Penn State University. So let's just follow through then on the notion that if Trump is on a roll here and is likely to either, you know, to even go into the nomination, even before the convention, have enough delegates. So what does the Republican establishment, and I say that with a caveat because I'm not sure what that is anymore, what can they do to stop him?
I don't think they can do anything to stop him at that point. I really don't. He retains that, you know, threat. He'll go in with a majority of delegates with a threat to walk out if it's not given to him. And I think they, you know, take a deep breath and say, this is the one we're going to ride with. But the ones who should be truly, truly terrified, you know, the establishment broadly writ large will, you know, just say, okay, we'll go with this and then we'll worry about the next election. But the guys who really should worry are the members of Congress, the governors, the state legislators, the Republicans, who are going to have to be on the ticket in November with Donald Trump. They should be terrified.
Well, on the other side, of course, Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders should be elated because, I mean, all the Democrats are fighting over nowadays is the executive branch, right? They've lost the House.
Yeah.
They've lost the Senate. They've lost, what, two-thirds of the state governorships and legislatures?
Yeah, they'll get a lot of those back. They won't get the House probably, but they'll get a lot of the rest of it back if Donald Trump is at the head of the ticket.
So, and what, say, if Bernie Sanders is running against Trump versus Hillary Clinton, how would that work out in your estimation?
I have no idea, to tell you the truth. I mean, that ends up, I mean, Donald Trump's, the campaign against Donald Trump on the Democratic side, not the Republican side, but on the Democrat side, writes itself. But so does the campaign against Bernie Sanders. So I just find it almost impossible to imagine how that's going to play out. I love Bernie Sanders and everything, but boy, I could write the TV ads, you know, the socialist, the extreme positions, I could write those ads myself. And you know, I think what you might see is either the highest turnout election in American history or the lowest turnout election in American history. It would be ugly.
So is that to say then, David Lowery, that the Democratic establishment is just as nervous of Bernie Sanders as the Republican establishment is apoplectic about Donald Trump?
Not as nervous. I don't think as nervous as Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders is, you know, the one thing that the Democratic establishment can think about is he is a professional politician. He takes the job serious and the job of governing seriously. He has a long record of serving in public service. So he's, you know, he may represent the classic insurgent in Democratic politics, the George McGovern type, which doesn't always give you good electoral results. But he is a professional. He's not a loose cannon in anything like the sense that Donald Trump is.
Right, but McGovern only won one state, Massachusetts, in 1972. I mean,
and the District of Columbia.
Oh, I'm so sorry, I forgot that. So that doesn't bode well. But of course, at this point, the pundits are pretty much awarding it to Hillary that she's got a pretty clear path from now on.
I think she's in a pretty strong position at this point.
Right, and Bernie would. He just has to somehow get those young people to stay in there, doesn't he, and get the numbers
up. The good news for the Democrats is it has not been the same kind of scorched earth campaign as we've seen on the Republican side. One commentator the other night was saying, you know, the South Carolina primary for the Republicans was last Saturday, the Democrats next Saturday. And Wednesday morning, the Democrats ads started. And the Republican ads were all vicious. And the Democratic ads starting Wednesday were, it's all sunshine in America, playing very nice.
Right.
So there shouldn't be as a big a makeup session among the Democrats after it's clear who the candidate is.
Right. Well, I think it's pretty obvious that if Hillary Clinton wins, she better not win at the expense of Bernie Sanders and alienate his supporters.
Yeah.
So it has to be a win-win somehow or other. But on the Republican side, I think you're absolutely right. They hate each other, those guys. They really do.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear that Dr. Ben Carson is staying in the race just to hurt Ted Cruz, who he's absolutely mad at. And I don't know what Kasich's motives are. We discussed that earlier. He obviously is angling for a vice presidency. But, you know, if he doesn't get out of the way, he's not going to get the offer from Rubio. But maybe, you know, Cruz is still, in terms of the Rubio-Cruz competition, assuming something happens to Trump, do you still think Cruz has a viable path?
Oh, I do. I mean, you know, that there is a residual, not a residual, it's been the dominant strain. It's receded a bit this time, but that strong conservative movement in the Republican Party. And Cruz does a good job of linking together both the evangelical and the libertarian elements of that. He taps into some of the anger of Donald Trump. The problem for him is that Donald Trump has emphasized the anger component of that, and that seems to be winning. But if something happened to Trump, I think a lot of that vote would take a new look at Cruz rather than Rubio.
So as a political scientist, David Lowery, have you ever seen anything like this surge of populism, both right-wing populism and left-wing populism?
Yes, a couple times, but not in the United States, in Europe. I lived and worked in the Netherlands for 6 years, and I was at the University of Leiden. And if you look at the emergence of the Pim Fortuyn and the Herd Builders anti-immigrant party in the Netherlands, or you can look this sudden blow-up of that activity in the UK with the brief flare of the anti-immigrant party in the UK. It feels an awful lot like that. A lot of id. And It's a classic political response to a problem that the public perceives, that the politicians seem incapable of answering it, and this will pop up. But it had frightening consequences in the Netherlands while I was there. I think it has potentially frightening consequences for the United States.
Well, that's one of the problems that we have, I think, in covering this Republican race, particularly the more ground that Trump gains, therefore the more legitimacy he gains, the less likely it is that the press will put him in the proper context. I mean, he'll be the front runner, and they'll forget the fact that he's a racist, xenophobe, that he's tried to ban Muslims from coming to the country, that he said the most outrageous things about Latinos, he said terrible, insulting things about women, and so forth. I mean, it's unbelievable that you can't sort of maintain that context. As the more he wins, the more legitimate he becomes.
Yeah, and it's degraded the quality of political conversation. But, you know, in part, I blame the press for this. I mean, why does Donald Trump not need to spend money on advertising? Because he gets all the free media, and it's irresistible candy for the media, particularly TV. It's like watching a car crash. But the more he's on, the more it legitimizes degraded quality of speech. And really what we need to do to a guy like this is shun him, the old-fashioned practice of shunning. But the media is doing the opposite.
So they're contributing then to the bigger train wreck.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And boy, they'll cover every minute of it.
So I just, you know, when we think about, we've talked about this train wreck, the idea that Trump could take the Republicans down in 2016, and the down ticket for the Republicans could be disastrous, that they'll win a lot of, they won't lose control necessarily of the House, but they'll lose the Senate, they'll lose governorships and legislatures, and it's got the entire party panicked, and yet that it appears there's nothing they can do about it. Because the one thing, you know, we just talked about how Trump is not pulled over for his racism, xenophobia, sexism, and all of the other isms that he violates. But on the other hand, he is clearly representing a frustration that the average people in this country have about politics and about gridlock and about lying politicians. I mean, could you believe what he said when he won in Nevada? He said he thanked, he went through the various people, the Christian conservatives. I thank you. I thank this. I thank that. I thank the educated voters. And I thank the poorly.
I love low educated voters.
No, he said the poorly educated voters. I love the poorly educated voters. Yeah. I mean, that was pretty amazing. So,
go ahead. The normal mechanism of response to this, if the past gives us a clue in American politics, would be for the two major parties, you know, let the dust settle, and then co-opt some of those issues, some of that anger. It'll be interesting to see how they do that, how the Republicans do that. But, you know, they've been stoking up anger for years and using it. And now they're reaping the whirlwind. So, you know, when you think about the Donald Trump lesson and you think about, you know, the one audience for that I've heard no one talk about, but the one audience for that is watching this and learning a lot are the candidates in 2020. And they're saying, look how Donald Trump did this. You know, campaigns in the next presidential elections are often modeled on the lessons learned in the previous ones about how to go ahead and campaign. We saw that with Jimmy Carter. Success in Iowa. We saw that with Barack Obama's 2008 success in pursuing caucus states and everything. What are the Republican candidates in 2020 learning from watching this primary system? And that'll be interesting.
Right, but the reason, largely speaking, that the electorate is mad and disgusted with politicians is articulated by both Trump and Bernie Sanders. But Bernie Sanders, I think, gets it right. He's basically saying why there's a structural problem with the economy and why you're getting screwed and who's screwing you. Whereas Trump just uses the anger and offers up the same kind of aspirational politics as winning the lottery.
Well, he really does emphasize. I mean, the Republicans for years have said, you know, criticized Democrats as you know, fostering identity politics and everything. But that is what Trump is doing. You know, fostering the identity of white underclass voters without policy content attached to it, and that's a little frightening.
Well, you know, that's, of course, history tells us when people become disgusted with democracy, they turn to more illiberal forms of politics. And I don't know that we're heading towards an American fascism, but we're certainly heading possibly towards a form of right-wing populism.
Yeah, it's certainly got a hint of fascism, doesn't it? The film, you see him kind of reveling in the violence at his rallies and stuff. That's, you know, I hate to use the word un-American, but in my lifetime, I don't recall anything like that.
No, it's very ugly. And frankly, without getting into hyperbole, at times when you watch Trump, particularly when he allows people to be roughed up and encourages that kind of hooliganism, he sort of leans back and pouts in that sort of way that Mussolini used to do.
Yes, exactly. Mussolini standing on the balcony and sticking his jaw out.
That's right. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Well, David Larrick, I thank you for joining us.
Okay. Happy to join you, and have a good day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with David Larrick, who's a professor of political science at Penn State University. Dr. Larrick has published well over 100 papers on the politics of interest representation, bureaucratic politics, urban politics, and public policy. And since 2011, he's been the director of the Center for American Political Responsiveness at Penn State University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking to Congressman Ted Lieu about the bill he introduced today, the No Money Bail Act of 2016. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He serves on the House Budget Committee, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and is a sponsor of the No Money Bail Act of 2016, a new bill just introduced in the House of Representatives today. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Ted Lieu.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
And could you describe the bill that you and a number of other congresspeople and congresswomen introduced today? Congresswoman Bonnie Watson-Coleman of New Jersey, Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence of Michigan, and Congressman Ruben Gallego of Arizona. So tell us what the bill says or would do.
Sure. We have a deep moral crisis in our criminal justice system. And one of the reasons that it's broken is the bail system. We have over 450,000 people sitting in jails and prisons who have not been convicted of a single thing. They are in jail or prison because they can't afford to post bail. This largely affects the low income and minorities, and we're essentially depriving people of their freedom based on income. It's discriminatory, and it puts people into a situation where they will be forced to plead guilty even if they're innocent simply so that they can get out of jail because they can't afford to make the bail money. What our legislation does is two things. It says the federal system can no longer use cash bail as the bail system, and to tell states they've got to change to a new system within 3 years, or we're going to start denying the states law enforcement grants.
So when you say, as you did at the press conference in Washington today, we cannot both be a nation that believes in freedom and equal justice under the law, yet at the same time lock up thousands of people solely because they cannot afford bail. We cannot both be a nation that believes in the principle of innocent until proven guilty, yet incarcerate over 450,000 Americans who have not been convicted of a crime. I think our audience and most Americans would agree with what you've said today. But what about your Republican colleagues that run the House, Paul Ryan and the Speaker? How can you get them to agree to what seems to be so reasonable in terms of what we stand for as a nation?
I believe that in a democracy, the side with the facts eventually wins, and all the facts are on our side. Keep in mind, not only does this discriminate against poor people and many minorities, it also reverses the presumption of innocent until proven guilty, one of the central founding principles of America. And it basically says people, in fact, are going to be sitting in jail with their freedom deprived, even though they have been convicted of a single thing. And that can get bipartisan support. There are some Republicans who are very libertarian-leaning, and I believe they will be receptive to this bill because they see it as a deprivation of freedom based on income. I also believe, by the way, that this is unconstitutional. I'm not even sure why our system allows this. So I'm trying to fix it legislatively, but I do hope that, you know, the courts will strike this down. I know there's multiple cases now challenging the bail system in America.
Well, according to the Department of Justice, and you've told us, Congressman Liu, that a part of the leverage you'll use to get the states to adopt the no-money bail system is the leverage of the Justice Department in giving out funds to the states. But according to a DOJ report, roughly 60% of the people in U.S. jails are pretrial defendants. That's up from 50% in 1996 and 40% in 1986. So what's driving this, you know, bail bonanza, if you will, because it seems to me that maybe you're up against the bail bond lobby.
They are a very powerful lobby. In addition, there is this fear among, I think, too many judges that if they somehow let someone go and that person commits another crime, that, you know, the judge will be recalled or not get reelected. And the facts simply don't bear that out. So Washington, D.C. shifted to a different system where they don't require bail or money bail, and they have a return rate of nearly 90%, which is about the same if you do require bail. It also is a system that incentivizes, right, the wrong approach, which is people are given sort of this no-choice proposal where if they need to go work or take care of their kids or do something that requires them to be physically present and they can't post bail, they're just going to plead guilty simply to get out of that situation. And we have, as you noted, 60% of pretrial defendants who are sitting in jail with their freedom deprived simply because they don't have the cash in their pocket. And that is grossly unfair and it's unconstitutional.
So, Congressman Liu, we sort of learned in a way about this war on the poor that's been going on for decades here in the United States with the uprisings in Ferguson's. And we learned that instead of protecting and serving the community, the police were shaking down local residents with speed traps and unnecessary traffic tickets, etc., that were generating revenue for the city and by extension paying for the salaries of the policemen, but essentially indenturing a whole bunch of people and putting them in jail because they couldn't make the tickets, and then the thing goes to warrant and then they get arrested, and then the bill just goes up and up and up and up, and all for what in the first place may have been a minor infraction or not even a legitimate one to begin with. So this seems to be in the same spirit of that. What do you think drives that kind of pernicious process in this country? Where is it, culturally speaking, where is this hatred of the poor?
Right. You make a great point. Our current bail system essentially criminalizes poverty. We had a speaker today, Kiana Williams, who shared her story. And she was put in jail because of a traffic violation, some traffic tickets. Because she couldn't pay the bail fee, she was kept in jail. She was also going to school at the time, trying to earn her degree. She was 12 credits away. This completely wrecked her life. She had to drop out of school because she couldn't attend the classes because she was sitting in jail. She didn't have the cash to pay it. And then they just spiraled, and it started to affect her in a whole series of different ways. And keep in mind, she is then being placed with some hardcore criminals, some very bad people, and she's there because of traffic violations. So you have this issue, not only you criminalizing poverty, but you're also putting a lot of innocent people or people who have committed very small infractions with some hardcore criminals, and it's grossly unfair. I do also urge readers to read an excellent article by Nick Tinto of New York Times. It ran last August, called The Bail Trap, and he goes through a series of different stories of individuals who were put in jail for very minor offenses and how it essentially wrecked their lives because they couldn't post bail. And I do want to thank my constituent, Dorothy Reich, for bringing this issue and that article to our attention, and it resulted in this legislation today.
And 2.3 million people are incarcerated in America, and of those 2.3 million, 450,000 can't make bail, and they've never been convicted of a crime, but they're stuck in prison. So that's about a fifth of the people in jail. So this is no small matter. So when you said that the city of, or D.C., the district where you are, Congressman, they don't do money bail anymore, and that the concern that judges have and prosecutors have is that if you let people out, they'll skip the next court appearance, and they'll go on the lam. But don't they have these bracelets nowadays that, you know, that you can put on people that basically track them and prevent them? They're fairly routine. So surely the idea that people are going to go on the lam is pretty overstated nowadays, isn't it?
Yes, there are a number of alternatives to a money bail system. In Washington, D.C., for example, they have a approximately 90% return rate. And that's because the studies show that many of these people are in jail for very minor infractions, and they will come back and contest their case or try to work something out. But there's no reason to keep them in jail, depriving their freedom, and essentially, you know, wreck their lives. And it's also important to consider that what makes much more sense is a risk assessment system where the judge says, okay, look, you've committed a serious crime. You're a flight risk. We're just not going to release you at all. Or you are not a flight risk. We're going to release you. You don't have to have bail at all. There's no reason it needs to be part of this equation. And jurisdictions that have moved to it have shown that they get approximately the same results, but a lot more people are not having their lives wrecked.
Yeah, but don't these electronic bracelets remove the possibility of a flight risk because they monitor the location where the person is?
Yes, absolutely. So California has instituted these ankle bracelets and other monitors for some crimes, and there is no reason that jurisdictions can't start using that instead of criminalizing poverty.
Well, Congressman, just in the last couple of minutes, because it's inescapable nowadays in this election year not to at least acknowledge this extraordinary election year we're in, and particularly on the Republican side, the rise of Donald Trump, who just won so handily in Nevada. Do you think that there's a possibility? I mean, already this is an unusual election year. Some people call it the year of the outsider, with Bernie Sanders, who's not even a Democrat, doing so well on the Democratic side, and Donald Trump, who's not really a Republican, doing so well on the Republican side. There's a lot of anger out there. How do you see this election year?
It is a very strange election year. I agree with you. I do believe that if Donald Trump were to get the Republican nomination, that he would lose in the general election. his ideas and his statements are, I believe, far too extreme for the American people. But what you see in the primary is a small Republican base that is voting for him, and then all his opponents are fracturing everybody else in terms of votes. So keep in mind, he's not getting 50% of these votes. He's getting less than that, but because he's running against so many opponents, he can be ahead of each of them. But when it's just down to two people, as it will be in the general election, I'm very confident that the Democrats will win.
But at this point, though, Trump's on a path to get the enough delegates. And my sense is, from talking to Democratic and Republican strategists, that Trump has a potential of taking the Republicans down, particularly the down ticket, congressmen and senators, and even state representatives and governors, because either he'll win it outright by getting enough delegates, and he seems to be on a roll, or if somehow the Republican establishment goes after him, he always has the option of running as an independent, which would also wreck the Republicans. So without making you and the Democrats feel too comfortable this year, do you think there's a possibility that Trump could take down the Republicans?
Yes. I am reminded of what happened when Pete Wilson did Proposition 187 and his very inflammatory anti-immigrant statements. He basically helped change California electoral politics, helped turn the state blue. And I think there's a very real possibility that Pete Wilson effect could happen nationally with Donald Trump, who has offended pretty much every minority group in America, and multiple religious groups as well. And it could really activate a lot of people, especially those who are young, to vote in November. And we could see a huge Democratic wave across America.
Well, Congressman Ted Lieu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Ted Lieu, who represents California's 33rd Congressional District. He serves on the House Budget Committee, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, and is a sponsor of the No Money Bail Act of 2016, a new bill just introduced in the House of Representatives today. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an update on Syria as Russia's President Putin engaged in a frantic round of diplomacy today, calling the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, and Israel. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me on.
And I just wanted to get an update because I do cover Syria as much as possible, but it's such an agony. It's been going on for so long. And there's just nothing but bad news. I think that one is conditioned to being skeptical about peace deals. Now, supposedly there's a peace deal in place. There does seem to be some relief for these besieged communities that Assad is besieging and starving to death, and also some of the Daesh people are also, there are pockets that they are also starving out. Those pockets, I think, received airdrops. But convoys have been getting through to the besieged communities, or some of them, that Assad has also been starving to death. Is that your understanding, Joshua?
Yes, there have been some UN deals brokered. And There are quite a few communities that are in terrible distress, but the UN has stepped in and helped put pressure and has brokered a deal because there are two Shiite towns in the north that were besieged. And in exchange for getting food into them, Assad and Hezbollah allowed food in to another town in the south of Syria. But today, Assad has moved forward and he's liberated, or he's taken back, the two Shiite towns that had been surrounded. So those are now out of the question. But there are plenty of areas that are surrounded by Assad troops, rebel areas, that are under intense pressure today.
And what about the largest city in Syria itself, Aleppo?
Well, Aleppo, since the beginning of the rebellion, or since after the first year, Aleppo was really chopped into two. There was eastern Aleppo, which fell to the rebels, and western Aleppo, which was continued to be held by Assad regime. Today, eastern Aleppo has been pounded into a terrible state. Most of the people have fled. It's still rebel-held, but it's very thinly populated. Western Aleppo was much more thickly populated. The Christians of Aleppo live in that area. They are the religious minorities, plus a lot of upper-class Aleppans, and that's still controlled by the regime. So, and then there's the countryside of Aleppo, which is big, and that's what makes it the biggest city, because it's got a bigger countryside than Damascus, at least included in the urban center. And that is now being pounded. Much of that was rebel. The Syrian regime is taking it back, and it's been taking it back quite rapidly recently because of the strength of Russian air power. And that's what we've been seeing most recently on our television screens, is refugees fleeing that area towards the Turkish border. And there's a bloody war going on there.
Well, but when you say the Syrians are taking it back, it does seem that this is all basically because of Putin's intervention. My understanding is not only is Russia using air power, they have Spetsnaz special forces on the ground, they have about 5,000 troops altogether. They seem to be the glue, both in the air and on the ground, that's responsible for the gains that the Assad regime have made. And for the last 4 years, the Saudi regime has been in retreat, and now the situation has been reversed thanks to the Russians.
Absolutely. The Russian intervention was a total game changer. Coming in September of 2015, President Obama said, we're not going to fight a proxy war with Russia for Syria. And it became quite clear that Russia was going to have its way. And the Russian Air Force has been devastating. And as we know, air power is so important, especially in this Iraq-Syria arena where it's largely desert. As the U.S. Air Force said after 1990, the Gulf War, we do deserts. And there's nothing but clear days. You can see every troop and person moving below you. The tanks glow in the dark in the evening time with night vision goggles because of the desert heat. So it is very difficult for any rebellion in this environment with a modern air force flying hundreds of raids every day.
Right, but that makes you wonder of why has the U.S., which has the greatest air power on the planet, and the so-called coalition of 60 nations that Obama often refers to, that we're degrading and destroying the Islamic State. There's a lot of people are skeptical about those claims, and they keep waiting for, and you know, the Republicans are piling on in this election year. So how come the Russians are being so much more effective, or are they?
Well, they're being effective because they're using a modern air force. They're effective in taking territory back because they've got a quasi-modern, but a unified national army in Assad's army to take territory as the Air Force goes through. The United States, although it's bombing very effectively against ISIS, has no partners to take the territory away. So even a very weakened ISIS can continue to rule because there's nobody challenging it for rule in that territory. And what's likely to happen to ISIS territory is as Assad begins to reconquer Western Syria, he will eventually move to eastern Syria and take the ISIS territory, because Assad troops are best positioned to take back that territory as the United States weakens ISIS. Now, the Kurds are taking some of it, and we have linked up with the Kurds, but the Kurds don't want to take a lot of Arab territory. They're trying to build a contiguous Kurdish state, and they're concentrating on a little bridge of land that separates two big Kurdish enclaves, Kobani and Afrin in the far west. And that's being highly contested by the Turks today, who are shelling the Kurds in that area as the Kurds try to take out rebel areas with Russians helping them with the bombing and build this big contiguous state along the northern border of Syria, where it abuts Turkey. So there are a lot of different militias out there. The rebel militias, though, are in full retreat under this devastating firepower of the Russian Air Force. They're in chaos. They're asking for a ceasefire. The United States wants a ceasefire. Russia, Saudi Arabia do. But Syria and Russia they're loath to give it, because they're trying to push their advantage now that they have the rebels in some chaos. And they want at all costs to take the territory along the Turkish border. That's where most of the fighting is going on now, because Turkey, with Saudi generous help, have been pushing in arms and reinforcements to the rebels in northern Syria. And the Assad regime is trying to cut off those rebel supplies. So a ceasefire is not to the interest, really, of Russia in Syria. The United States is twisting their arm to comply, and so they may do some partial ceasefire, but it's touch and go right now.
Well, Vladimir Putin has been very busy on Wednesday. He's been on the phone for 3 hours speaking to the Saudi Arabian King Salman, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani, and, of course, Assad, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to pull together some kind of a ceasefire deal. The U.S., of course, are pretty skeptical. The British are even more skeptical, particularly of whether or not Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, can deliver anything, whether Putin is really basically calling the shots, which appears to be the case. What do you think's going on with Putin's taking personal charge of this Syrian ceasefire situation?
Well, this is a Russian game now, and it's high stakes for Putin, because his success really depends on being able to make Assad a winner and to reestablish this authority of the Syrian state. Saudi Arabia is apoplectic. So is Turkey. Turkey has told the United States, if you continue to support the Kurds in Syria, the PYD, that we consider a terrorist organization, that Turkey considers a terrorist organization, you have to choose between us and the Kurds of Syria. And he says that the arms that America's been supplying to the Kurds in Syria are being given to the Kurds in Turkey and are being used to kill Turkish soldiers and police. The Saudis feel completely betrayed by the United States, because the rebels that they've been supporting and spent billions of dollars arming are now being destroyed and are asking Saudis for support. And the United States is stepping aside. And Saudi Arabia sent airplanes to Turkey and said, we want to go in and play a bigger role, but America has to go in with us. And America, I think, is not interested in getting involved. Obama does not want to get sucked into Syria. And the Saudis feel betrayed, and they feel like the United States is allowing Russia, Iran, to really set up a big security zone stretching from Hezbollah in Lebanon right through Syria. Of course, Iraq today is dominated by Shiites, pro-Iranian, and this big Iranian, the Shiite crescent is being established. And that security structure, with Russia ensconced, could become a real essential part of Middle East security for the next decades. And that is very worrisome to Saudi Arabia and Turkey. The United States, of course, is saying, you know, we've got to get out of this zone. We can't take on Russia. We don't want to get in a proxy war there any more than we do in Ukraine. And so Obama's trying to cut his losses. He doesn't see that as devastating for the United States. I think, you know, he's trying to retreat from some of the obligations the United States has and doesn't believe we can be a policeman of the entire world.
The so-called leading from behind, which, of course, is grist for the mill with the Republicans in this election year.
But, you know, Ian, the Republicans, if you listen to Donald Trump, said it's a bad deal. He wants to, of course, destroy ISIS and has talked in big terms about ISIS. But about the Syrian civil war, he doesn't want anything to do with it. And he said Iraq was a huge disaster, I think he said.
Right.
And he even extolled the virtues of Putin. So it's not clear that a Donald Trump, for example, would get any more involved in Syria than Obama would. And Cruz took Obama to the woodshed on this issue of regime change, and he said that Obama's policy has been terrible, that overthrowing dictators, whether in Syria or Libya, in Yemen, has caused the spread of chaos and the emergence of ISIS and al-Qaeda throughout the Middle East, which is endangering America, and it's undermined security, and that this Obama policy is bad. And so, in a sense, he's said we've got to go back to supporting dictatorships and stability in the Middle East. So neither of these top Republican frontrunners looks like they would be promising. I mean, if I were a Syrian rebel, I would be pretty depressed. Clinton
If you're a Syrian rebel, you'd be counting on the one neocon on the Republican side who's allegedly coming in second. That's Marco Rubio. So he wants to escalate the war.
He does.
But since you've got so many sources on the ground there in Syria, Joshua Landerson, do the daily newsletter and blog, Syria Comment. What do you hear about these reports that haven't been confirmed, that a group of Russian generals were killed in an attack on a Russian airbase in eastern Syria by Ahrar al-Sham, which, of course, is a group that lost its leader thanks to the Russians? So is that possible payback? Have you heard about this?
You know, I've read about it, but I'm not sure what the status is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Russians will declare it eventually if it's in fact true. And so that's just that is something I can't
the fog,
you know,
of
I can't
war,
confirm.
Right?
Yeah,
the fog of war. But what is so clear, though, I heard Senator William Cohen, the former Republican senator and Secretary of Defense, pointing out the obvious, which is when Putin intervened in Syria, that was concurrent with this huge flood of refugees into Europe. And that flood of refugees continues. And that it's Putin's strategy to flood Europe with refugees. And he allows Syrians to go through Moscow, through a border up with Finland and Norway in the north. So it's pretty clear to me that Putin has a double strategy. Not only is he securing a situation in Syria, he's making life miserable for the Europeans. He wants to put the squeeze on the Europeans so that they'll one by one break off from the sanctions over Ukraine and Crimea. And that he really has a pretty cynical strategy there. And, of course, we know that the influx of refugees into Europe puts social strains and political strains and gives rise to right-wing European parties, some of which Putin directly finances, as he does with Hungary's Orbán.
Well, that may be part of his calculation. Of course, there are a lot of other players that are adding into this strategy. Turkey has been allowing the refugees out. Turkey is apoplectic that it's had to hold the bag for 2.5 million refugees where Europe doesn't want them in. And in fact, you know, a lot of cynical analysts have said that perhaps Turkey's letting them out because Turkey's being paid now by Europe to keep them in. And this is a way of getting more money and leveraging and also showing the Europeans you can't just expect me to hold the whole bag. But these refugees have been pouring in from Libya. And wherever there's regime collapse, refugees have been pouring into Europe because people trying to get out, and there are no police states, as there used to be, like Gaddafi, to stop them. And countries like Turkey, which are overloaded, have no interest in stopping them anymore because they need to relieve the pressure that's put on their own societies. So letting them go into Europe is a very convenient, that's where they want to go. And it's hard to stop them once you get regime collapse. There are a lot of Iraqis, about a third are Iraqis and Afghans. Every country that's had regime change or regime collapse and is a failed state today is just bleeding refugees.
Well, who made them fail states? need I point right. out that it's the United States and George W. Bush? And, of course, to some extent...
you said it, Ian.
Well, except for Libya. That was on Obama's and Hillary Clinton's watch. So,
yeah.
It's very... all of what you're telling us, Joshua Landis, adds to the urgency to do something about this bleeding wound. And do you have any optimism about the current situation where there's a tentative ceasefire, Putin's diplomacy?
I don't. I think that Putin is very interested in getting something temporary. The United States is feeling, I think, very weak in this situation. And Kerry wants to deliver some kind of a ceasefire so that he doesn't look completely weak. And I think he's put a lot of pressure on Putin. And Putin, is eager to give a half loaf here and do something in order not to get, punished by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, others, and not to allow this coalition to form against him. But the real question that for the future of Syria today is whether Assad is capable and strong enough with Russian help, Iranian help, to reimpose his order on Syria. And that's the real question here. If he is, even though he's a brutal dictator, it'll allow many refugees to go home. If he can't do it, and the resistance is tough and continues to get lots of arms from the Saudis and Turks and other places, this war will continue to grind on. And in many ways, the refugee crisis is driven by the lack of solution to the Syrian civil war. And the two sides, and because it's become such a big proxy war, even though the Syrians are exhausted and have no money left, have suffered terrible attrition in their ranks, because all the foreign powers, whether it's Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah and so forth, and Iraq, willing to support the Shiite side, or whether it's Saudi Arabia, the United States, Europe, Turkey, and the Gulf countries willing to support the Sunni side, the money has continued to flow, as well as very advanced arms, which is allowing for this very high, destruction rate and insecurity in Syria. And that just keeps the people flowing out. And so long as there's not one side doesn't win, we're going to see the refugee flow continuing.
Joshua Landis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.